This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's time to break the silence and open up the dialogue around the topics of miscarriage and baby loss.
No more shame, no more taboo. Let's ditch it for the sake of our children.
The ones who are, the ones who will come.
And in memory of the ones who never came to be.
This is the Worst Girl Gang Ever podcast.
Recording in progress.
I was going to do that. Recording in progress.
Please do not.
Do you want to give it a go, Nikki?
Please do not say
recording
in progress.
Good one, yeah.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of The Worst Girl Gang Ever. Today we're joined in our virtual studio by Nikki. Hello.
Hello, hi.
Thank you so much for coming, Nikki.
Thank you for having me.
We haven't whacked out the old virtual studio. What did we used to say every single time? Joined it, it was just in the studio. It was so funny.
Yeah,
we don't do that.
And lockdown ended, we started saying virtual studio, but we haven't said it in a while. I don't know what made me just start saying it then. But Nikki, we were going to be talking to you earlier in the year, I think it was, but you didn't feel ready for it then. But you recently got back in contact, and here you are.
Here I am. Yeah, that was back in October. I just returned to work. I worked for the ambulance service, and I think it was a lot bigger than I thought it was going to be, and I struggled a lot. Things have improved. Here I am.
Good. Well, let's sorry, you go, Laura.
Is there a delay?
No.
I was going to say, I think often people think when they go through an experience of loss, they want to be doing something and want to be proactive. And I don't know if it's just sort of filling a void or whether it's a distraction or what, but often the emotions then start coming in thick and fast. So thank you for being honest with yourself and with us and choosing the right time to come and talk to us.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell us a bit about what happened back then, last year.
So my husband and I have been trying to conceive for 4 years now. It was when I turned 30 that we started to conceive, just by coincidence. But what that means is now that every year older I turn, so 33, 34, it's 3 years later, it's 4 years later. And I think we're both very relaxed people. We're both paramedics, so we're both quite practical, and we never really got to that point where we were getting really stressed every month. So the years just sort of rolled by without us realizing, really. And we got to the 2 year point and thought, well, actually things aren't happening. Maybe we should go and get a few tests and just start that process of understanding what's going on. So that's where it all started, really. So we went to our GP, but very much from the start, so I have a stepson who is 11, and from the start they said, we will do some testing for you, but it will be very limited and we can't help you any further because you've got a child in your life, because you've got a stepson, you're not going to get any help from the NHS with your fertility. Which, yeah, that was, it was very hard. I was prepared for that. I'd done my research, and we've lost the postcode lottery, really. We don't live in an area that has great IVF access, so I had sort of accepted that. So we're just outside of Cambridge.
Okay.
So we, you know, we went through all the tests and they all came back completely normal, which I guess is good. And it was reassuring, but it sounds bad to say, but I almost wanted there to be something wrong so that I knew where I could target my efforts. Yeah. And so that we knew.
You're definitely not alone there. I think so many women that we speak to, you know, either were relieved that there was something wrong or felt so frustrated by a diagnosis of, you know, unexplained infertility. Because when there's something wrong, you know what to fix, don't you? Or you know how to start. There's a plan. Exactly. When there's something wrong, there's a plan. And when you're given this diagnosis of unexplained infertility, or there's nothing we can see, then you're kind of just as lost as you were to start with, aren't you?
Exactly. And I've always been such a maternal person. I couldn't wait to have children. And because I wanted it so badly, there was always a very small part of my brain that said, well, that's not going to happen, because that's something, you know, something you desperately want. Why should you get that? You can't be that lucky. So then when we didn't conceive, my brain was sort of like, well, I told you so, especially for no reason. It's because you wanted it so badly, sort of thing. Yeah. But, you know, it is what it is, sort of thing. So we, again, I'd done my research. I was following a few Instagram accounts by that point, like the lovely Sophie Martin, the infertile midwife. I'd been following her story. And so I sort of knew how to do my research into fertility clinics and what IVF involved. So we reached out to a private clinic and started that process, which we were quite honest with friends and colleagues. We talked about it quite a lot, and I found that helped, that people were aware of what we were going through and that we were quite happy to talk about it.
Did you think that opened it up for difficult conversations as well? You know, when people say that they're going for IVF, lots of people say, oh, that's really exciting.
Gosh.
Yeah, okay, it's a bit exciting, but it's also really freaking stressful, and it's not a guarantee.
Yeah, and it's terrifying, and it's expensive, and all those sorts of things. Yeah, absolutely. It did open up those conversations, but then, you know, later on when we did go through a miscarriage, those conversations, it got harder for people, and those conversations definitely stopped, even though we'd been quite open from the start.
Mm-hmm. So did you fall pregnant on your first round of IVF?
First round, yeah. Weren't we so lucky, we thought to ourselves, because our IVF process had been quite straightforward. There weren't too many hiccups. I did get a phone call from the consultant one day when we were halfway through, and she said to me, I've just noticed your BMI and you're too light. We can't continue with IVF until you put weight
what?
On. Yeah. And she said to me, do you have an eating disorder? And I said, oh, no. And she said, OK, put on some weight and then we can continue. But otherwise we can't continue.
But hang on, how far through your treatment were you?
We'd gone through all of the testing. We'd probably spent about £1,000 at that point. They'd known my BMI from day one, and we were ready for the egg collection. And I thought to myself, I mean, firstly, if I did have an eating disorder, that's an awful way to approach it.
Mm.
Also, I just don't know how you can treat someone like that. And she just hung up. It was like a 30-second conversation. We can't continue. Put on some weight. See you later.
So what did you do?
Well, it's a bit of a funny story. I desperately tried to put on weight. I'm naturally slim, and I know I'm really lucky with that. You know, I get a lot of comments, oh, you know. So I tried to put on weight and just couldn't, and ended up feeling really awful because I wasn't eating the right foods and I was just taking in too many calories. So in desperation, I bought some diving weights because they're tiny and they're quite heavy. And I put them in my bra. I had this whole thing planned out because it was only a few kilos that they wanted me to gain. And again, just out of desperation, I thought, how am I going to gain this weight? I can't do it naturally. So I'm going to put a few sneaky weights in my bra. So I used to walk into the scans clinking with big weights. And what a bizarre situation.
Isn't that like, but doesn't that just demonstrate like how this, not warps isn't like it's too much, but you know, how it affects your mind that you're treated so unfairly about something you're so desperate. You go in there with a heavy bra.
Yeah, and I'd thought it through, like I can't put them in my jeans because what if they ask me to get undressed for the scan? So I'm going to have to put them in my bra. But I did panic, like what if the metal messes with the ultrasound machines? And I had this whole narrative, and yet it is warped. It's completely warped. I can see the humour in it, but it's also awful.
Yeah, it's awful that they, like, I think the BMI thing, I don't know why they still do it, because it just seems like such a shit way to you know, such an unreliable way, because everyone's body mass is different, right? It doesn't mean
we all know that BMI is a big fat lie. There was once an article in The Sun about it.
Was there, Laura? Tell us more.
Yeah, I was on page 59 of The Sun.
Not page 3.
No, unfortunately. Fortunately, not sure. Yeah, it is. It's so old-fashioned, and it's all based on, you know, white 40-year-old men, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
How we're being measured against them. So did you manage to have enough weight in your bra to pass the test?
They didn't weigh me again. That's the awful thing.
You're joking.
No, I'm not joking. From that moment on, saying we can't continue, put on weight, no one ever said anything again, and I wasn't weighed, and we went through IVF and got pregnant. So the stress that caused, apparently...
Back to them.
No.
Absolutely mental.
I should have.
I hope the weights weren't too expensive.
No, a little bit, but not too bad. No, I've still got them. I'm keeping them as a souvenir.
Yeah.
Oh dear. That's so funny.
I might go diving one day. I don't know.
Mate, well, you've got the kit now.
I know. No, I can't imagine anything worse. But yeah, I look like a diver. But yeah, so that was the only hiccup slightly that we had. The rest of the IVF was, I guess, straightforward, and we got pregnant. And in our 2-week wait, we got a puppy who you can see in the background. Our dog had died a few years earlier, and it just the stars aligned, and we got an opportunity to get a new dog. So, you know, we were joking, oh, we're going to have a new baby and a puppy, and it's going to be chaos, but it's going to be absolutely lovely. So I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, that last day of your 2-week wait where you can test. I was up with the dog. And so I weed in a cup, a mug that I just got out the cupboard, and actually is still in the cupboard. I forget. My husband reminds me when we get it out, like a builder or a guest, and he like gives me a knowing look. Like, don't forget, that's the cup you weed in. So I should probably throw that out. But
you could put your diving weights in there.
Yeah, exactly. I might just put
them
on a
shelf. That's a good idea.
Yeah, all the memories, happy memories. So I weed in a cup at 4 o'clock in the morning and just left it on the side and went back to bed. And then at 9 o'clock in the morning, when he woke up, we tested it, and I covered the test with a tissue and unveiled it, so we both saw together that we were pregnant, and it was lovely. And I cried and I said, the only time I've had a positive test is on a COVID strip. You know, that was the first time I've seen 2 lines not on a COVID test. And it was lovely. And then we were pregnant, and we were so grateful that that's how it happened. But there was still that tiny bit in my head that said, well, it's still not going to happen because you wanted that so badly. And unfortunately, it did sort of play into that narrative because we had a miscarriage.
Do you find that being paramedics, you've seen a lot of people go through miscarriage?
Yes, a lot. So that's
something that you were probably more aware of it than any normal person.
I guess we have a fairly realistic view, if not a warped view, of other people's lives, and we do see the trauma that other people go through, and it does make us feel so lucky that we do have our health and we've got a beautiful house and we've got each other. It does make you feel grateful for what you have. And I have seen a lot of miscarriage, so I thought I was fairly well informed, but we had a missed miscarriage. And that's not something, you know, that's something that you go to your scan and you find out about. So that isn't something that you would see, that people wouldn't call an ambulance for that. So that isn't something that I was aware of. So that came as a surprise.
You didn't have any bleeding or cramping or anything like that. You were thinking, okay, we're good. We're getting closer to that scan.
I was pregnant. And I mean, 6 weeks to the day of the IVF, I started to feel sick. All day, every day, I felt horrific. And I knew that was coming. My sister had had 2 pregnancies and she felt sick all the way through. And then people would say to me, oh, it's great. It's a really good sign of your pregnancy hormones. You feel so sick. And I tried to feel grateful, although I felt awful. I tried to appreciate that I was having these symptoms because I was growing a baby. And I remember having a conversation with my husband on the way to the clinic. And he said, how do you feel? And I remember saying, if I didn't feel so sick, I'd be a bit more worried, but I feel so pregnant. And because of the IVF, I was a bit bloated and I had a little bump, which was ridiculous because it was so early on, but I felt pregnant. And I walked into that scan pretty confident that we had a baby growing. And then you know yourselves, within seconds, there's no heartbeat. And then that's when everything just crumbles away, everything stops. And in that moment, the reality hits that we're not going to have a baby. We're not going to take
it. For you, Nikki, did it, because certainly from my experience, like you say, in that moment, the reality hit. But for me, I think the reality kept hitting with it, like weeks, days afterwards, weeks afterwards, because you spent your whole time thinking baby's going to be due then. And I remember my baby was supposed to be due around Christmas. And I remember being really excited because it meant that I didn't have to make any political decisions about where we spent Christmas. I was just like, nah, everyone can just work around me this year. And I remember a couple of weeks down the line thinking about those plans and then suddenly realizing that I had to think about Christmas again. And it was like the most bizarre trigger, because it brought things all back again about what I'd lost and back to the day and back to the moment and stuff. And it's like this experience that keeps on taking from you. It's not just that moment when you realize that you're not going to be a parent like you thought you were going to be, but it's that those moments afterwards that you're robbed of something else.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, even a year later, in the modern world of social media and algorithms, yeah. Every time I go on Instagram, because in those early days I'd got a little bit excited and I'd research the pram that we might have and what outfit would I take them home in, all those sorts of things. I let myself have a little bit of hope. And because of the wonderful internet, all of my algorithms are now set to look at this new pram we've just launched and here's some parenting tips. So yeah, we're surrounded by constant triggers that you just can't avoid.
Yeah, you can't avoid them. And then, you know, along those lines of triggers, then you've got the friends, presumably you've got some friends or family members that are along the same lines. You said your sister had two pregnancies and, you know, all that stuff with your friends and colleagues and stuff having babies. And if so, how have you managed those triggers, or haven't you?
I don't think I have. I think so. I've been so lucky working for the NHS that actually I took a long period of time off sick. And also working for the ambulance service, we have the most wonderful consultant psychotherapist who helps us deal with trauma that we might see. And I spoke to her, and I think she's been amazing. She has helped me deal with and process everything that we've been through. And I think that is genuinely the only way I've got through it, with her help and support, and of course, a few family and friends. But without that, yeah, I think I'd still struggle even more.
So, the warriorship, we wanted to come and tell you a little bit about it, didn't we, Bex?
And in case you're already going, why? We don't want to know about a fucking ship. The Warriorship is our online membership for warriors in this community.
It's packed full of stuff. So we just want to tell you about some of the stuff. All of the content from all of the courses that we ever run is in the Warriorship. So there's loads to get your teeth into.
And we are also developing modules for what happens after.
But not only that, we've also got a ton of educational workshops running once a month. In the coming months, we have got body positivity workshop, gratitude workshop, and loads, loads, loads more.
And on top of that, we also have a resident mental health specialist.
And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough, there's 13 events every month. And there's stuff popping up all the time as well that other people are organising that you can be a part of. So it really is thriving.
And all you have to do is head to the link in our bio or visit our website, and you can be a part of this too.
We'd love to see you there.
How was the aftermath of that scan? How were things between the two of you, and what option did you choose for the management?
So I think we went into professional mode. We were quite stoic. You know, we stood up and I got dressed and we said thank you very much and we walked out. And because it was a private clinic, we had to phone the NHS early pregnancy unit. So we got in the car and I got on the phone and we were on hold for a little while. And I think at that moment, about 20 minutes later, that's when I just broke down sobbing with the reality of what happened. So we went to the early pregnancy unit the next day and they were wonderful. They were so kind, and we were just sort of swept up with their knowledge and their kindness. And they talked us through all the options, but we were still, again, very stoic. And I felt bad for them as professionals having to deal with us. And we'd say, you know, oh, they keep giving us the sad eyes, and we had to get put in the sad room to have the news delivered to us. I think we weren't viewing it through the eyes of two parents that had lost their baby. We were trying to be really brave about it. And we chose to have the medical management, which thankfully worked. I know it can be problematic, but for us it worked. But what that meant is we had to go back a week later for another repeat scan, and then a few days later to have the medication. And all the time, I felt pregnant. I felt sick all day, every day. And I just used to cry each night, being like, it's not fair that I'm feeling this unwell, and it's not for a purpose. I'm not growing a baby anymore. I think those were some dark times. Yeah, that's not fair at all.
No, it's really
not fair.
I'm pleased that the medical management worked well for you. We hear such horror stories. And so, yeah, it's reassuring to hear it run smoothly, so to speak. Well, how was your husband? What sort of, did you have any difficult conversations?
We did. We had a lot. We had so many difficult conversations. And I think, again, that's the one thing about the sort of relationship that we've had. We've had a lot of challenges. You know, we have a stepson. We've dealt with a lot during our relationship. And I think with our profession, we're very good at communicating. So we never had any trouble discussing our feelings. But I think he very much was looking after me. And everyone would ask him how I was. And I worried about that. That's not fair. He was going through his own trauma, but I was the focus. And I don't like any attention anyway, but I really wanted to make sure that he was okay. But no one else really addressed that. Which
no,
I
it's tricky, isn't it?
Bonkers. Yeah.
It's when you, did you experience like difficult feelings of resentment for, you know, the fact that your husband had a child already? Did you find that more difficult after your loss?
I think sometimes I struggled, and maybe that is an element we didn't talk about so much, because I felt guilty for having those thoughts. But there were days when I thought, you know, you've got your baby. You've had a baby. And although I'd really struggled to have that conversation with him, because that's not fair. But I guess I did experience some loneliness, in the sense that I felt I was losing a baby and my only chance to have a baby. But he had his child, who I have a wonderful relationship with. But yeah, there was definitely that slight mismatch, although that probably is the one conversation we haven't truly had, because that's not fair on him. And he would never feel that way. He went through it with me exactly the same way. We both lost a baby together.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a slight mismatch there, I guess.
Was it something that you've spoken to your stepson about?
Well, that was an interesting journey. We decided to talk to him about IVF because, you know, he's old enough. We wanted to have a household where we talk about problems and we just sort them out. We don't hide things. And with the sharps boxes and the injections, we knew he's an intuitive kid. We knew that he'd pick up on something. So we decided to talk to him about it. And it ended up being a bit of a sex education talk, which actually we found really valuable. And I think he appreciated. I think it's good to have those conversations. He was really excited. And the prospect, although we were realistic, the prospect of having a brother or sister, he was really excited about that. But unfortunately, we have him 50% of the time, but that means 50% of the time he's not with us. And he did spend some time with his mum and then sadly come back to us, saying, I don't want you to do this. I don't want a brother or a sister. And saying, it sort of spiraled into him saying to me, I don't want you to be a mum. I don't want to be part of your family. A lot of things that were probably just an 11-year-old's thought process of processing this news. But then there were a lot of words that also weren't his own, and he had been slightly influenced. So unfortunately, and I'm sure many blended families understand the challenges of having a stepchild, but he did carry on with the narrative of, don't do this, I don't want you to be a mum. So we didn't tell him when we got pregnant, and then we didn't tell him about the miscarriage, because we thought, why should we tell him about something that he's lost, that he wasn't aware that he had in the first place, or that he actually didn't want in the first place? So we didn't continue to tell him about that, which again, that was hard, because going through the miscarriage, he still kept saying, I don't want you to be a mum, don't do this. And I'm thinking in my head, well, it's not going to happen now anyway. So
that must have been really, really challenging.
That was very hard. That was an element, I guess, just an additional element, a really awful time. that you just don't need. But I guess it's just part of our story.
Is it something that he has stopped talking about now?
Yeah, he didn't talk about it. He didn't talk about it any longer. I think he thought if he didn't speak about it, then we wouldn't have a baby. And maybe we should have continued to talk about it and tell him what had happened, because maybe there's a part of him that wonders, well, why didn't they have a baby? But I think from our own self-protection, we stopped that conversation because it's just not something we could continue. We had to protect ourselves.
Yeah.
And we didn't carry on talking about it.
Triggers.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is with blended families is that you can't, you have a limited influence over the child, but you have no influence over the other parent that they're spending time with.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that, if you had that conversation with your stepson and then he went back to, you know, the people that he spends the other half of his time with and had different conversations, you have no control over what is said or done. And then whatever filters back through that kind of lens back to you may just hurt you more. And I personally, having lived in a blended family for a number of years, I understand your challenges, and I understand that toxicity of when you don't have control over everything that is fed, and the damage that can occur through that third party. And I really feel for you there. I think it must, whether it's conscious or not, there must be some resentment there. In the mix of all those really, really challenging relationships. I'm so sorry that's something that you've had to deal with on top of the grief that is the loss itself. It's just, as you say, it's just this whole situation is so unfair.
Yeah, absolutely. You feel like you're constantly sort of firefighting lots of different scenarios. And when you're really vulnerable, it's hard. It's hard to keep hard to keep that going. But yeah, we got through it because I don't know what the alternative was.
Well,
and I was lucky, like I said, I was lucky to have some time off work. I just couldn't imagine dealing with other people's trauma when I couldn't stop crying myself. So you can't have a paramedic turn up to you and, you know, they just start crying in front of you. That was my biggest fear. But as part of that, I needed to get signed off by my doctor. Working in healthcare, I know that people phone up their doctor and chat for 10 minutes. And at the end of that consultation, they'll say, oh, but I just need to be signed off sick. So I was quite direct with my doctor in saying, you know, hello, doctor. Good morning. How are you? I've been through this IVF miscarriage. I need a sickness certificate, if that's OK. And he turned around and said to me, I don't have any evidence of that. I'm going to need proof, if that's OK, because I can't take your word for it. So bring me some proof and I'll sign you off sick. He said, I'll phone you back in 3 days.
And what sort of proof was he wanting?
Well, exactly. What I think he was saying was, I'm really sorry to hear that. I hope you're okay. I haven't received any discharge papers from the early pregnancy unit. I wonder if you can, I don't know, chase that up for me. I don't know. I'm trying to reason with it in my head. But I don't, yeah. He asked for proof of my loss, which I found devastating. And I thought to myself, well, what if I had miscarried at home and dealt with it myself? What proof do you want? What if I didn't have discharge letters from the hospital? I don't know how I was meant to prove it.
You'd think as well, like as a paramedic, you'd all be on the same side. I don't know if that's, you know, I understand that there are rules and regulations and stuff, but I also think that that's not a very human way to deal. To talk to another person. And you'd think in the medical profession, he'd understand that you've seen lots and lots of horrid things. And you would, why would you lie about that? It's, I don't know. I think that's really awful.
Horrendous.
And as you say, what if you can't? The last thing you want to do when you've been through such trauma and such devastating heartbreak is have to think about how you can prove that you've been through that. Like, that's mad.
Yeah. And that shame that I felt, and I felt so belittled. And I can't imagine any other time you'd phone your GP and they'd ask you to prove it. And if I was lying about having a miscarriage, that's a whole separate issue. That needs to be unpicked. And that, you know, you need to be kind and support to that person for whatever reason. But I hadn't made it up. I had had a miscarriage. And I delivered the proof.
Yeah. Well, normally you would, the hospital would send their discharge letter to the GP, right? Or you would be under the care of the midwife, and they would, they'd know that way. I guess it's just, I don't know, a miscommunication. They've not, that I can see what they're asking for, but they've not gone about asking it the right way, have they?
Yeah.
Do they know that you're a paramedic? Because I know that personally, sometimes I would pull out the I'm a nurse card, and other times I would think, well, why should I have to?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they knew. You know, you go to your GP surgery and you just see whoever's available. So I don't know if he knew. But yeah, like, you know, it was just a complete lack of human empathy and kindness. And that certainly didn't help my recovery process.
That's the point, isn't it? The point isn't, as Laura says, the point isn't that you have to work out your I work in the medical profession. The point is that it should be completely irrelevant where you work and who you are and what your age is and all of that stuff. And just actually, how much does it take to, even if that's the question that you have to ask by your professional standards, how difficult is it to say, I'm so sorry to hear that. I really hope that you're okay. Is there anything else? Is there anyone I can refer you to? Is there any information you need? You know, this is the stuff that needs to be being taught. It's almost like bedside manner stuff. It's not difficult. We can all learn, whether we've been through this experience or not, we can all learn how to treat people with kindness and respect and, you know, integrity during this absolutely horrendous time. And why aren't we doing that? Why is that not coming naturally to people in the medical profession that presumably join the medical profession because they want to fucking help people? Like,
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I guess that played into my not wanting to go back to work, because I was terrified as a clinician. I thought back all of those conversations. Gosh, I hope I have never made anyone feel that way, because it's so easy to go to 6 or 7 patients each day, and it's part of your working day. It's not a big deal to you, but to that person, it's this one event in their life most of the time. And it's huge to them. And now I know, you remember every single word that said to you and every single thing that happens. And I was terrified of saying something wrong to a patient. And I really hope I haven't in the past. I don't think I would have ever been that unkind to someone.
I think it's more than what you say. I think it's more than what you say and do. I think it's the way that you make people feel. Like, people don't necessarily remember the exact wording or what they heard or anything like that, but we all remember how we felt. And we've spoken to so many people now on the podcast and in our membership who have had their recovery has either gone in a sort of positive way or in a really negative way. And so much of it is because of how they were treated at that point, at that sort of falling off point, is how they were treated. And it just, I think more awareness needs to be spread for how essential this frontline support is. These sonographers, these GPs, all these people standing at the front giving that bad news or being the first person to speak to that woman or couple after they've experienced a miscarriage at home or whatever. These people need to be trained. They need to be better equipped to deal with the emotional and mental side of things, because that is the shit that comes back to haunt you when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and it's 6 months down the line and you don't know why this has happened to you. That's the stuff that comes back, all those mini things that don't seem like much, that may not seem like anything, as you say, in a doctor's day, because they've had however many patients since however early they started working. But my gosh, for someone, that's their everything. That's their life that's just crumbled.
Yeah,
it's not treated seriously enough.
And then how are we in 2023? And it's not, you know, we are saying that people with miscarriage who have experienced pregnancy loss and miscarriage, they're not treated with compassion. How is that a thing? You know, it's dreadful.
Yeah, it's really dreadful, and it's very much a part of what we're planning on in the future, isn't it, Laura?
Aye, it is, Captain.
So what's been going on for you since, Nikki? So that was last October, a year ago.
So June was the miscarriage. I returned to work in October.
Right.
I've still been speaking to our trust psychotherapist a year later, and she's played a wonderful part in my recovery. And I've gone back to work saying, you know, people said, oh, I haven't seen you for a while. And I said, well, I was off, you know, I had a miscarriage, I lost a baby. And I've gone back to work talking about my experience and just trying to reflect what you guys are doing, because you've very much been with me since the start of my journey on dog walks and trips to and from work, listening to the podcast. So I'm trying to carry that on, and in the ambulance service, talk about miscarriage and raise awareness of baby loss and do what I can to make sure that my colleagues treat patients the right way, but also probably most of my colleagues have experience of pregnancy loss and miscarriage, and to allow them to talk about it and see what I could do. It's very much a work in progress.
Open up conversations. More conversations happen, don't they?
Yeah, the amount of people at work that I've told about, you know, I said what's happened and they said, oh yeah, I've been through that. Which I didn't know that before. It's crazy.
And what does the future look like for you?
I don't know. I don't really know if I'm at the start of my journey or at the end. I think we'll give IVF another go. I'd really like to. I don't want to, in 10 years' time, I don't want to have any regrets. So I don't want to be without a child in 10 years' time, but, you know, broke. I've got a strained relationship, and our whole life has been dedicated to this. So I want to make sure that we live our lives and we are so grateful for what we have. But then at the same time, again, in 10 years' time, I don't want to think, oh, I just wish I'd tried one more time. Or maybe if I'd have done this, it would have worked. So I don't know where we're at. I know that we'll give it another go and see what happens. And we have still got that hope every month. Maybe it'll happen naturally. But I guess we've just got to see and enjoy life for what it is for the moment.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And is your husband, is he on the same page in terms of all that?
Absolutely.
That's good.
Definitely. Good. And since our miscarriage, we got engaged and then we got married, which was lovely. And I try to think that although we've been through something awful, and I don't think that happened for a reason, I think it's just something awful. But as of a consequence of us not having a baby, we got engaged and we got married. So I try to think of the positive that has come out of that awful situation, although I don't think it happened for a reason. He's on board. We talk about it often and we're quite open to just seeing what happens and see how it goes. Keep our fingers crossed, I guess.
Brilliant. Well, we will keep our fingers crossed for you.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thank
you. Yeah, do keep in touch. Let us know how things are going, won't you? And you know we're here for you. So keep listening to the pod.
Oh gosh, I will. And thank you so much for you guys, for everything that you do, because it genuinely helped me through my journey. And I'm sure so many other people would say that too. So you're doing an amazing job.
Oh, well, it's a privilege to be able to be here in your ear hole.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, we will
Nikki.
Talking to you on your next dog walk, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Wonderful. All right, well, take care and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.